Welcome to the NSCA Coaching Podcast, special episode.
I'll tell you, the most thing is to have, and you get people to do things if you're enthusiastic and you have a smile on your face. Here's a great point, especially for college and professional even more. These guys are being evaluated every game on television by the coaches, by the press, by the fans. They don't need to come in after they've lost a game and see a long face. Geez, we got beat last night. You've got to be a positive influence.
This is the NSCA's Coaching Podcast, where we talk to strength and conditioning coaches about what you really need to know but probably didn't learn in school. There's strength and conditioning, and then there's everything else.
This is the NSCA Coaching Podcast. I'm Eric McMahon, the NSCA Coaching and Sports Science Program Manager. Today's episode is a special collaboration with Gatorade Performance Partner, and I'm joined by veteran coach and Gatorade Team Sport Manager, John Jost. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Eric. It's always great to be here with you and team up. And man, today we have a truly a special guest who is without question a legend in strength and conditioning, and somebody who has shaped the profession across multiple sports and multiple generations. And I'm so excited for this session today.
That's right. Today we're joined by Al Vermeil, the only strength coach to win championship rings in both the NFL and NBA, and a pioneer in integrating performance science into elite sports. Al, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Glad to join you.
So you're the only coach, like I said, to win championship rings in two professional leagues, and you've worked in professional baseball. I don't want to skip that. That combination it's a rare accomplishment to have success in this profession at that level, let alone across all those professional leagues. How'd you adapt your training philosophy over the years to meet the unique demands of those different sports?
Well, my overall philosophy never really changed. How I did things changed, but I always believe the ultimate thing was, besides hopefully, lessening injuries, was to get them to improve their performance. And I always felt that most important thing in performance was explosive power. Because in the sports I dealt with, you know, it's instantaneous. It's an impulse. You're not running the 100 meters, you know. So everything has to be, is very short time. So I always started out believing that if you wanted to be explosive and fast, you had to train with that emphasis. And through the years, I just added things. When I first started coaching, I didn't know how to teach the Olympic lifts. I did them, but it was the greatest reverse curl you ever saw. So I knew I wasn't in the right direction. And I was coaching high school, and I brought in guys like Jim Schmidt, who was over at the Iron Palace in San Francisco, learned some things. Then I brought in, and I was a high school coach this time. Then I brought in Russ Knipp, former world record holder. Then Carl Miller. I became friends with John Garhammer, Mike Stone. You know, I just a myriad of different people. Much later on, I had Dragomir come in. I had my son was trained by Yuri Vardanian. I had, my Schmitty from York. So in terms of the Olympic movements, all those people contributed. And at the same time, when I started coaching, I had spent a year at Kansas State University under Vince Gibson. I was a graduate assistant. Now, don't become too impressed with that title, because I was a gopher. I went and picked up his kids, picked up his laundry, vacuumed the offense, you know. But I watched what they did in the off season, and they were doing the things, I don't know what they call them today. They call them floating sprints, ins and outs. And so when I went back to high school after that year, I started to really emphasize speed. And we call it the off-season program at that time. We didn't call it, because you worked on speed, agility, all the other things. So those early experiences shaped my philosophy. The other thing that shaped my philosophy, and when I was a college football player, I'd had some injury problems and I didn't know how to work around them in the last couple of years in the off season. And I felt I'd lost my explosiveness a little bit. And at 195 pounds, you couldn't afford to lose that. So all those things kind of, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better technique. I learned to cycle things. When I trained in college and we didn't have a Boyd Epley, you know, if you didn't go heavy every, you know, you went heavy every day, there was, you loaded it up. And that worked fine when you're younger, but when you start to get to your true maximums, it creates problems. So that's it, kind of shaped my own personal experiences. And then, you know, I started reading about plyometrics in about 1975 or four. Fred Wilt put an article out, and I think it was Athlete and Coach. No, what was it? Scholastic Coach, I think it was called. And I started reading it, and then I thought, eh, let's kind of put it aside. Then I read it again about 6 months later. Well, I was at Moreau High School in Hayward, and Don Chu was right up on the hill. So I got together with Don, and we started implementing plyometrics about 1975, 76. And I was fortunate as an athlete. I was a high school shot putter. I ran the 100-yard dash, but I just got in the blocks. I didn't train for it. And I saw that where shot putters were stepping off the bench and throwing a shot. So I had my athletes step off a bench in a hitting position and hit a bag. And at the same time, another former grad assistant from Kansas State was at Maryland working with Randy White. He had the opportunity to be with Frank Costello, and Frank was running downhill. So he sent me Frank Costello's downhill program. So by 1976, we were running up hills, downhill, doing plyometrics. We'd become much more proficient in cycling our workouts. We became much better at the Olympic lifts. And then the other thing I'd got from Vince Gibson, he had a nice, they had a circuit program of movement, and where you went through different movements for 30 seconds and rested. So by that time, we were putting that all together. But the major goal, because that was football, was to be explosive and be able to accelerate. And I think you have, you know, anything that doesn't do that, doesn't contribute to that, it's a waste of time. And of course, that's the time Nautilus was coming out, one set of 10 to failure. And I'm sorry, but I think that whole philosophy did more harm and then anything else. And one of the things that, you know, they always said go slow, but I think if you went fast in the machines, you'd break down, break them. The other thing I never liked was machines, because you don't sit playing sports, you stand. And obviously you find out later, you know, you're using all the stabilizers and all that. And then as the years, when I was with the 49ers, I brought in different coaches. With the Bulls, people used to ask me, how much new equipment did you bring in? I said, no, I got my original equipment, but I spent $18,000 or $20,000 a year bringing in consultants, paying for them. You know, we brought, and then at that time, I became a very good friend with Charlie Francis, who was one of the brilliant coaches I've ever been around. I brought in K.O. Hockington. I brought in Carmelo Bosco, and I became friends. I brought Mel Sipp, Poliquin, Victor Lopez, who was a really good speed coach, sprint coach at Rice. So I brought all these people in, and each of them added something to my knowledge. And I always recommend young coaches, if you really want to be good, go learn to coach a team sport. I don't care if it's seventh grade girls basketball or boys. Learn, know how to organize groups. And that was a great advantage to me, because I started out as a football coach. And then I became a head coach, and I had to operate three different programs, freshman, JV, and varsity, and coordinate them all. We all ran the same system. And when you coach a team sport, you coach on the run. The other thing I recommend young coaches do is go out and learn how to coach Olympic lift, even just one of them, and track and field, because you'll learn mechanics. And plus track and field, if you want to be explosive, you got the shot putters, you got the jumps for jumpers and sprints for sprinters. I think you having all that background, and I coached track and field. 1 year I was a throws coach at Casa Roble. So all those things has contributed to my background. And my background, if you can picture a pyramid, got bigger and bigger over the years. The base grew.
Coach, let me ask you a quick question about the plyos and Olympic lifts. There is no question that you were really, really ahead of your time, you know, bringing in plyometrics and Olympic lifts to improve athletic performance. And, you know, still today, there are coaches that there are sport coaches or position coaches that push back on Olympic lifts specifically when they may think, oh, that's for football players. And so did you experience any pushback from, you know, either coaches or athletes? And then how did you, I guess, prove the value of those training methods of the incorporating the Olympic lifts and plyometrics?
Well, obviously in high school, I didn't have any pushback. Yeah, especially when I was in Moreau High School, I was a benevolent dictator, so you didn't have any problem.
That's a luxury, huh?
But when I went to 49ers, the guys that worked out, and it wasn't, you know, we didn't pay them in the off season to come and work out. And we had a lot of turnover in those early years that I was with the 49ers. But the guys like Randy Cross, Dwayne Board, Keith Farn, all those guys, Billy Ring, they didn't object. Some of them had been, Cross had been exposed to him as a thrower at UCLA. And I'll never forget, Randy came in one day and they had the world championships or a big meet and Alexei was lifting. He came in, he said, "You're right. They actually jump off the ground." And, you know, so they bought into it. And again, I think it's, if you know what you're doing, then they'll, and you have a good plan, they'll buy into it. When I went to the Bulls, it was all new to those guys, and the guys that work with me did it. You know, we took Billy Cartwright, we got him. He had been, Billy was probably in his 30s when we got, you know, Horace, Scotty. But what you have to do with them is modify them to what they can do, not what they can't do. Other words, some guys' limb lengths are so long and, you know, you have to raise the bar up or teach it at different positions. Or maybe one guy's better at the power snatch than the power clean. You just modify and adapt. And I really didn't get a lot of pushback from the players. Now, with that said, there were certain people that, you know, wanted to push back. And I pushed back. And I'll leave it at that. And I continue. I'll just leave. This will give you the conclusion of the outcome, the pushback. We continued to do them right up until I left. You know, Horace Grant cleaned 300 off about a 6-inch block, but that was Horace. But Horace Grant could do anything. And here's a great example for young coaches: if you could picture you had a Gatorade cup, and the rim, the width, the diameter of the rim represented your nervous system. So you have that rim is wide, so you got a good nervous system. The fluid inside represents strength. All you had to do with Horace, he had the nervous system, is fill up that cup. Because then when you dumped it out, it was so big, it came out at once. Now you'll get other athletes that Gatorade cup is someone's drink out of them and squeeze the top. So you can fill it with water, but trying to widen that and improve the nervous system becomes a little more difficult. But one of the tidbits, and this is from experience of coaching, we had we had some different guys that weren't as explosive. And I put the bar at mid-thigh. And when they did the weight at mid-thigh, it looked so much better than when it was lower. Well, one of the reasons they were taller, and it made it look slower. But what I found them more efficient. Well, I had read some papers by Dr. Tahani, and he made some interesting investigations and found that people that aren't as explosive do better with a shorter flex. The deeper you get them, the less efficient they are utilizing their nervous system, and they have less fast twitch muscle fiber. Where you get a guy at a course, he's got explosion or Randy Cross any place along the range. So what I started emphasizing that they made sure they did a certain amount of the lift from what they would call today the power position. We named that way back in the 80s. So that's how you tweak little things. Then you get that same athlete, and you may do the other thing. I always liken it to a car. My dad is in the Sprint Car Hall of Fame and in the National and the California Racing Hall of Fame, and my brother, both of them, my brother drove open wheel race cars and had the last Offenhauser that could compete against the Chevys. So the downstroke to me is eccentric contraction. The upstroke's concentric. Well, some people don't get much out of the eccentric. So to try to help the concentric, I would do things like pause push presses, and I would shorten the dip, because if you watch poor jumpers, they'll jump with their back, they'll bend over or take a great big dip. Well, you don't have time in sports, whether it's football, baseball, bat. When you're accelerating, especially, you don't want to wind up. And if you're in football and you're a wind-up tackler, you just got run over by the running back. So I would take and have them do it from a short motion. I'd either have them pause or go ahead and counter movement, but I cut the dip down. Now, people say, well, they didn't lift as much. The point was trying to make them more efficient in a shorter range. And that's the other thing about the power position. When you're in that power position and you do a power snatch or power clean, it's all or nothing. It's instantaneous.
That's really, really good advice of being able to meet them where they're at and let them soar with their strengths.
Coach, one thing I love coming through is your process translates loud and clear across generations of coaching. I hear you digging into the scientific concepts, thinking through it, but also bringing a practical element to your coaching. Hey, players play on their feet. Why are we sitting down? The real basic things that provide a foundation for us to explore these scientific concepts further. Another thing I really love hearing is all the outside influences you brought in to complement your skill set as a coach. And that's huge. That's huge today. I mean, you see that with the growth of performance staffs to just how big they are and how many experts we have in the locker rooms and in the clubhouses. I want to dig into that sports science a little bit more. Tell us about your time machine. This was a groundbreaking tool for measuring athletic performance at the time. I think it's a concept that we're pretty familiar with today, but how did that come about? And did you view it as innovation at the time?
Well, it came about, I was with the 49ers at the time, and I saw them, they would hook a string to a guy and measure his acceleration for a few steps. And it was a very crude. And Don Chu and I were going to start a business. So I got the original little version. In fact, the young man graduated from Merle High School where I coached. And he built me a little thing. You know, how many of us have heard Quick Feet? You know, that used, you got to have quick feet. So they never measured it. And I had a little drill I had picked up from a guy at Christian Brothers High School in Sacramento when I was assistant. They had a great program. And they did a drill. If you can picture stairs, you put your right foot on this first stair. Now the left foot goes on the same stair. So you go right foot, lead, left. You do three of those. Then you go left foot first, right foot. Now, the next thing you do is you alternated feet. Right foot on the left. Now the left had to go the next air. So I'll repeat. I'm starting at the bottom. Right foot on the first air, left foot on the first air. Now the left foot goes on the second stair, then the right, you alternate. And I gave that to our running back coach, Billy Matthews, because he was testing all these running backs that were coming out. And I think in was my second year there. So I'd be 1980. We're starting to say. And anyway, he talked about who could do it and who couldn't. And it was interesting looking at them as players later. So I wanted to find a way to see who had quick feet. So we developed this thing and we did the vertical jump and the 40 and all that. And then when I moved to Chicago, I got a company. I had a company in California. Another company started to use a little laptop. Well, they kind of Hashimoto'd it. When I brought it back to Chicago, I had it finished. Well, by that time, I could measure change of direction. You'd get in the middle of a photo sensor, and there was a random choice. The time out of the photo sensor to the first map, it was a total of 10 meters. So you went 2.5 meters, let's say, to the left. I got the time to the left, the time your foot was on that mat, back to the right, that time on the mat, back to the middle. We got the vertical jump, the multiple vertical jumps, the 40, the quick feet. In there's a way to simulate playing defensive back. I sold it to Al Miller, had one of those at Denver, and loved it. And Ford changed direction. I had a scheduler in there. I can't think of anything, a lot of things we had. The problem was I developed it at my own cost. If you're going to develop something, go get a sponsor so it money doesn't come out of your own pocket. And the other thing, make sure the sponsor can then market it. Don't market it yourself. But what was beautiful with the, I could measure and quick feet. And everybody talks about improving quick feet. I've worked with guys that didn't have quick feet and did everything in the world. Never got better. And it, when I was developing this device, I had naturally quick feet. And we had a running back at the 49ers. And his name was Billy Ring. And he could do, I can't remember exact numbers. It was very fast. And the running back, one of the running backs we had that didn't have good feet, didn't. And so everybody says you're going to improve quick feet. You really, I never found a way to improve it. That's just
really
the way.
Interesting.
And then the vertical jump, you know, we had Don and I in the early 80s, we were getting the contact time and divided in the height, but we didn't call it the reactive strength index. We just didn't name it. And we would have guys step off an 18-inch block box, hit the ground, and then we had a way of measuring their height. And then when I went to the Bulls, we did the repeat vertical jumps. And when I became a friend of Carmelo Bosco's, you know, that was really good. And again, that's a reactive, you know, that was the other thing about Horace. He had it all. He had that reactivity. And now what you would call a great strength reactive index.
So, Coach, with your performance model and the progression or progressing from strength to power to speed, you know, your pyramid, your framework that so many coaches reference today is, you know, it is was really groundbreaking. Can you walk us through how you developed that pyramid and how, you know, modern coaches can use it today?
Yeah, I probably developed it by accident, like everything. I was just trying to find a simple way for myself, you know, because periodization can be confusing. And, you know, I'd read some things by Verkhoshansky, and he made a statement, and Charlie, You can train a lot of things, but you got to have a direction. So the pyramid, and if you look at the base, and we haven't talked about the work capacity, and that's where Steve Javorg's complex come in. And I still believe in that. And what it is I tried to find a simple way for me to understand. So when we get an athlete, where does he fit in that pyramid? You know, we talk about testing. And you guys are all coaches. How many times did your boss come to you or the coach saying, this guy could really play if he could run fast? And you said, and you go out in the weight room and you're working on the weights and you say, why aren't you sprinting? Well, first of all, a guy probably didn't have a good work, wasn't strong enough. And unless you're naturally elastic, if you're not strong enough, we know strength has a great deal, and explosive strength with high loads has a great deal to do with the first 10 to 20 yards.
Yep.
So when I tell about the pyramid, if speed's what you want, well, where are you on that thing? Yeah. What's your squat? And I'm still a big believer in the old back squat and front squat.
You know, thinking back of the era and the athletes you worked with and had the chance to be around, what was your approach to building trust and getting buy-in with the variety of athletes? The one that's going to run through the wall for you and the one that doesn't want to?
Well, in high school, it was easy because I decided who got a uniform. But, you know, and a side story to that, I got a call 3 days ago from one of my former players going through something difficult and called me and said, thanks, coach. He said, I'm able to handle this because we had 4 days. People think I'm nuts. We did. But basically, when I was a young coach, I wasn't smart enough to think about the word trust and buy in. It wasn't around. I just went in there with myself and just did the best I could. And what I found, this is a true story from the 49ers. There was a player named Cedric Hardman, and Sid had this deep voice. And he was a stallion. He comes in one day and he kind of got a little edge. He said, hey, Al, guys say this Olympic lifting is good. Teach me. Took about 2 seconds. One day after practice, right after, and we're wearing pads. It's none of this, no pad stuff they have today. Sid comes in, says, I need a good workout, Al. Cleans and push presses 300 pounds. So at the point being, the players felt I was competent, and they also realized my ego didn't get in the way from bringing in people like the Steve Javorics and other people and to help. And they were seeing that we were trying to get better at our profession. You know, another guy I didn't mention was Rob Panarella was instrumental in dealing with some of the, oh, you shouldn't squat this deep, you shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that. You know, you have some of those people in every organization. So back to the question, know what you're doing, coach what you know. Don't coach what you don't know, but go learn.
I have one kind of fun question, coach. And I was, before we got on this podcast, I got my own workout in, and during my workout, I'm thinking, every time I see coach at a conference, he looks incredibly fit and looks like he still works out pretty hard and moves really well. And I'm really curious. What do you do? How do you stay in shape? What advice can you give me? Because every single time I go down and work out, it's like it gets harder and harder every year.
Yes, it definitely does. I'm 80 years old and I can't do the things I used to do. But working out is the one thing that I can't do without. I can't miss workouts. Now, here's the thing I have to do at my age. I have to take somewhere between at least two, most of the time, 3 to 4 days between lifts, let my body recover. And what I've had to do, I can't clean or snatch anymore because my wrists don't bend as good. I can't front squat anymore. So I use dumbbells on my shoulders, and I can usually I can always get 40 in each hand and do dumbbell squats. I still snatch pull. I won't tell you the weight, it's too embarrassing. The other thing I've adapted to, I do dumbbell presses. I had my shoulder was bothering me a little bit, and I love push presses, so I'm just getting back to pressing the bar. But it's doing what your body says you can do. And one thing I did with the trap bar, and this could apply to athletes, and the trap bar isn't new. I'm convinced someone 100 years ago had something like that. They just didn't market it. But what I do with it, I turn it upside down, so I'm lifting at the same height I would lift an Olympic bar. And then I'll do a couple sets there. Then I'll turn the handles over and move up 4 inches. Then I put it on another 4-inch block. So I go from low to normal, and I add 4 inches. So I go from the low position to normal, 4 inches, and that puts it about 16, and then I go to 20 and maybe 24. So I add weight, or I'll go from the top down. And that was hit Carl Miller's old descending squat program. And I just did that. And what's interesting, when I get done doing that and go do my snatch pulls, I'm much better at, because I'm trying to find a way to work, differently. And that has really worked really well for me. And in the how I would utilize it, what I found is when I get done, I back squat better. I'm much more erect because it allows me to put more weight through the system. And if I was coaching today, if I had guys that couldn't squat, I would might use some version of that.
This is great advice, and it's also, I'll have to say, inspirational. I'm going to start incorporating a few of those things in my workout tomorrow.
Coach, you're still bringing it. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us today and the entire NSCA community. Your legacy, it's a huge part of the foundation that we all build from in this profession. So thank you for everything you've done. I love that you're still willing to share. I've seen you at a few conferences on panels the last couple of years, and it's just exciting to hear you.
Oh man, absolutely. This has truly been an honor to have this conversation, and I think we could go on all day.
Well, the one thing I have to do now, because I can't swim because of my shoulder, so I put one of those blue vests on and do paddle in the water. Just remember the people listening. There's a lot of ways to skin the cat. The most important thing is to know the cat you're skinning, what they need. And just here's the other thing. Some of the things that I did a long time ago, I didn't see other people doing, but I went ahead and did them anyway. So sometimes just because no one has ever done it doesn't mean it's that you can't.
Thanks so much, Coach. That's it for this episode on the NSCA Coaching Podcast, brought to you in collaboration with Gatorade Performance Partner. Learn more about how Gatorade Performance Partner fuels important conversations throughout the industry at GatoradePerformancePartner.com. And a special thanks to Sorenex Exercise Equipment, a regular sponsor on the NSCA Coaching Podcast.
Hey guys, it's Dr. Brian Mann coming at you from Texas A&M University. Hey, this is a call to arms. If you feel like there's something that needs to be done, something that needs to be changed, this is your call to go ahead and sign up for the volunteer opportunities within the SIGs, the different committees, or just to get involved in your local chapter. Please go to the website for more details.
This was the NSCA's Coaching Podcast. The National Strength and Conditioning Association was founded in 1978 by strength and conditioning coaches to share information, resources, and help advance the profession. Serving coaches for over 40 years, the NSCA is the trusted source for strength and conditioning professionals. Be sure to join us next time.